So, as Abby just said, as you just saw her draw, you're going to see this drawing a lot. This is our map. This is our roadmap. So, we have the text. And what we want to do is run to today, to our audience. But we have been convinced that we need to let the text be king. What we're saying needs to come directly from what the Bible is saying. And so we need to do some work in order to do that. The first thing we need to do is we need to go to, we call them, then, or the original audience, you could call them. Then we need to go to the cross. And then we can come to today. So this first leg is exegesis, which, if you've never heard that word, it just means to bring out what's in the text. The text has a message. We're just looking to pull it out so that we can see what it is. And so, sorry, this is falling off a little. So we just want to carefully study the text, find out what the meaning of the author was for his audience, them, then. Later, we're going to fill these in with theological reflection and persuasion, but for now, we're going to stick on this line of exegesis. And so part of this work that we do to understand the text as it was understood by the original audience is the work of looking at context. Because the context always helps us understand things better. Let me give you an example of this. Here are three things that I have said in recent history. Number one, we don't lick one another. Number two, please don't put your feet in her hair. And number three, oranges are not weapons. Those are real sentences that I uttered in the very recent past. So if that were all you knew about me, you might think I was crazy. You might think this is just some crazy person on the streets of Chicago talking to herself. But once I tell you what the context of these three sentences are, it will inform the meaning of my words. So I was recently out in Seattle watching my nieces and nephew while my sister and brother-in-law were in California. He's in the military. He had to do some sort of training. So I went out for a week, and I got to spend the whole week with my nieces and nephew and play with them and hang out and bring them to school. My nieces and nephew are 12, 6, and 4. And we were inside my sister's house every time I uttered one of these sentences. They were all uttered in that same week. And most of the time, I was speaking to the 4-year-old and the 6-year-old. So those are a few different contexts that I just gave you. I told you who the original audience was, my young niece and nephew. This helps you understand why I might be saying these things. It helps make sense of these phrases. It makes it a little bit more normal if you've ever spoken to young children or been around them. If I had been speaking to a 20-something-year-old, if I had been saying these things to my kids who are 17 and 15, then you might be thinking that's a little bit more weird. But understanding the original audience helps you to understand these. Also, I told you where I was saying these things. I was inside my sister's home every time I said these things. So if I had been in a grocery store talking about how oranges are not weapons and don't put your feet in her hair, then you might think, okay, this woman is not qualified to take care of young children. Right? You might be thinking, we need to get her sister and brother-in-law back home as soon as possible. So both of these pieces of context bring understanding to, or in the language of our worksheet, they inform the meaning of my words. And this is what the principle of context is really all about. Context, the principle of context says we must understand the context to see how the original audience understood the text. And so I'm going to give you a drawing to help you remember this, because we are all about drawing at the Simeon Trust. There's T for my text, and then I'm going to draw circles around my text because the context is what is surrounding my text in several different ways. So there are four types of context that we ask for on your worksheet, and we're going to talk about all four of them tonight. There is historical, literary, biblical, and cultural. All these different types of context surround our text. And so we're going to turn to the word, and we're going to work this example together and in our tables, and I'm going to explain each one of these contexts as we go. So we're going to be coming back to each one, but what we're going to start with is historical. So let's turn back to that Mark 7 passage that we just read with Abby, but we're going to take a bigger chunk. We're going to take Mark 7, 1 to 23. So could I have somebody, I know this is a long text, but could I have somebody read that out loud for us, please? With a loud voice. Yep. Thank you. Okay, that was a long passage. Let me go back through it really quick and sum it up. The passage starts with a question from the Pharisees to Jesus about hand washing. It moves to an answer from Jesus in which he quotes Isaiah, then a rebuke from Jesus where he quotes Moses, and then finally an explanation from Jesus for the people and his disciples. So the emphasis of this passage is on what makes a person clean or unclean. Without context, a lot of this makes sense, but we're going to see how much more we understand it after we look at the context. So we're going to start with historical context. The definition of historical context is the situation or circumstances of the original author and audience. Okay, how do you think we're going to find out what the historical context of a passage is? What do you guys think? Okay, you can look it up. You can go to a Bible dictionary or different helps. Sometimes we can find it in the passage itself, right? We're starting with historical context because in the Gospels, historical context is probably going to be the least helpful for you. When we're talking about historical context, what we're talking about is the audience who received the book and the author who wrote the book. So a lot of times, if you're in the epistles, this is going to be easy to find by looking in the book itself. It's going to tell you what was going on at that time that the author was writing, where he was, what he was doing, and it's going to tell you what the situation of the audience receiving the letter was, because he's saying, I'm writing you this because you're suffering, or I'm writing you this because we're rejoicing. In the Gospels, what we have to remember is that the authors of the Gospels were not sending out weekly newsletters. Right? They weren't writing blog posts following Jesus around from town to town saying, okay, this is what he's doing now, this is what he's doing now, this is what he's doing now. So the audience is not the people in the story itself. It's the people who received the Gospel of Mark after the author wrote it. And the truth is, we don't know a whole lot about the original audience because we don't know who received it. It was given to the world. It was given to the church at large. And we don't know a ton about the author. There are many gallons of ink that have been spilled debating who this author was and who the audience was. And so there are people with many more letters after their names than I have. I have none. Who don't even agree on who the author and the audience are. And so we're not hugely helped by it. The strategies for finding out the historical context, they're pretty basic. It's think about the circumstances of the people who received the book. Ask yourself, why did the people who received the book need to hear this? It's think about the author. Think about why did the author write the book. So as I said, historical context in the Gospels, it's not the most helpful context that we're going to find. If you have a worksheet and you have nothing for historical context in the Gospels, it didn't help you understand the passage, that's fine. In question two for the context, we say consider these four contexts. You don't have to answer every single one of those. If you don't find a context, I just want to free you up. I feel like everybody, I'm hearing sighs of relief. Yes. If you don't find context, or if you find context but it doesn't inform the meaning of your passage, that's okay. You can leave that blank. The point of context is to help you understand how the original audience understood the text. So if you're not finding anything, or if it doesn't help you understand the passage, feel free to leave that blank. That being said, we do know a little bit about the original. I'm saying that we don't know a lot. We do know a little bit. So what had already happened by the time the book of Mark was given to people? What do we know? Yes, Jesus had died and he had risen again. We know that. At the very least, we know that. And so that is going to help us. That is one thing that we need to keep in mind as we go through this book and read it. We don't want to be thinking, okay, what did the people who don't know who Jesus is in this book need to know? That's not the question we're asking. The question that we're asking is, what do the people who received this book after Jesus' death and resurrection, how is that helping us understand what's going on? Why the author wrote these stories down? We have to remember, Jesus's ministry on earth spanned 3 years, is the general agreed upon time. And so why were these stories written down for people to read and understand after he died and rose again? When we're looking at historical context in the Gospels, that's what's going to help you out. So does anybody have any questions about historical context? Yes. Okay, so what was happening historically? So she's asking, will historical background ever be helpful in teaching the Bible? Because when she thinks about historical context, she's thinking, what was happening historically at that time? Yes, if you're in the epistles, then absolutely they're being persecuted by the government. It's helping you, it's still helping us here, because we know it was after the death and resurrection, so we're not thinking, you know, pre-New Covenant. We're not thinking Old Testament prophets. We're not thinking the nation of Israel before they were sent into exile. We're thinking about a specific people in time. So it is helping us in that way. It's just not helping us as much as other contexts will help us in the Gospels. If you're in the Old Testament, if you're in the prophets, absolutely. You want to know, when was that prophet writing? When was that book handed over to the people? Was it pre-exile? Was it the middle of the exile? Was it after they had come back to the land? When the people who received the book, what's happening to them? Not the people in the book, but the people who received the book. That's what we're aiming at with historical context, because we want to know, what did this passage mean to them then who received the message? Does that help?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes,
so the historical situation or circumstances of the original author and the audience. The audience is the people who received the book. That's who he's writing to. And so, again, we don't really, I mean, the book of Mark, it wasn't like the epistles where it was sent to a specific church with a specific problem. It was written down. Now, there are other ones. Luke, the beginning of Luke. Does anybody know what Luke says in the beginning of his book, who he's writing to? Yeah, he's writing to a specific person. Do you remember why he's writing to Theophilus?
To explain things from himself. Like,
yeah, to explain things clearly. Yeah. How does that help you understand a random passage in Luke?
Well, maybe.
Maybe a little. Maybe not as much as other contexts, though. But it is something that you want to have in your mind. Mm-hmm. Okay, any other questions about... Yes. Not in this, so she's saying you're not, she's asking, are you not giving the historical context of the people in the book? That's what's going on in the book. When we talk about context, we want to know what's happening around the story. What's happening? So the people in the book is going to come up in literary context. Yep. Okay. Other questions on historical context before we move on? Okay, great. Historical context. Important, not the most helpful in the Gospels. All right, our next context is literary context. When we talk about literary context, we are defining it as the passages on either side of the text. So this can be the most immediate passages, right before and right after, but it also extends to the rest of the whole book. So the immediate, right before and right after, are probably going to be the first ones that you look at. They might be the most helpful. But it can also go, it can go back a couple of chapters. It can go back to the very end and the very beginning of the book. So how are we going to find the literary context of the passage that we're studying? Pardon? Repetitive reading. What specifically are you reading if you want to know what's happening right before and right after? Yep. So our strategy, I'm still in highlighter. Read the passages on either side. And I would say read the whole book. If I'm teaching a passage, I'm going to want to read the whole book. I'm going to want to know how it's connecting in the whole book. The passages on either side for sure. But yes, read the whole book so that you can see how that passage connects to the rest of the book. Ask yourself, why is this passage here and how do the passages on either side help me understand this passage? How do the passages before and after help me understand my passage? So those are the questions that we're asking ourselves when it comes to literary passage. Yes?
So my passage for tomorrow is chapters 1, verses 1 to 15. So when I was trying to apply this specific instruction to look at the before and the after,
yep.
I didn't have a before.
Yep. Yeah, so her question is she's presenting the first passage of Mark 1, 1 to 15. She doesn't have a before passage. Then there's nothing to inform your passage before. So then you want to look at what comes after. Don't worry if there's nothing. And if you're in the last passage of the book, there's nothing that comes after. There is no passage. Yeah, so don't get caught up. Don't get caught up in trying to find like a tricky way around the fact that there's no before passage. Or if you're in 1 and 2 Samuel, then you should probably look at the next book. But in the Gospels, yeah, don't get caught up in trying to figure out, like, what actually comes before this? Nothing came before that. That's fine. Okay, any questions about literary context? Okay, so we're still in Mark 7, 1 to 23. So what I want you to do is I want you to look at Mark 6, 30 to 56, and 7, 24 to 37 with your neighbor, and I want you to talk about how the literary context informs the meaning of the text. So in other words, when we're doing context, we have to first figure out, number one, what is it? That's the first question. What is the literary context? Sum it up. Come, put it in your own words. And two, how does it inform my text? How does it help bring understanding to my text? What nuances? How does it help shape? How does it help shift me into the right direction when it comes to my text? So go ahead. I'm going to give you about 4 minutes, 4 or 5 minutes, to look at Mark 6, 30 to 56, and 7, 24 to 37, and answer that question with your neighbor. Okay, you know what? Can I call an audible? Can I have these three tables plus you guys do the previous literary context, and Margaret's table and these three tables do the following literary context? Okay, we're going to come back together. I'm hearing a lot of good conversation. Let's start with this half of the room that did the previous literary context. Okay, we're going to answer the first question, which is the easier question. What's going on in the previous literary context? Who can sum it up for us? Point out some things that are going on.
John the Baptist is killed.
John the Baptist is killed. Okay? What else is going on? Jesus sends out the 12, okay? What else is happening? Feeding of the 5,000. So there's a miracle. Jesus walks on water.
Jesus' disciples are hungry.
Okay? So there's some miracles. Jesus' disciples are hungry. John the Baptist has been killed. He's healing the sick. Okay, so that's what's going on. That's the easy part. The question that we want to answer is, how is seeing this previous literary context helping us understand our text better? What answers did you guys come up with? How is it helping to inform our passage? Yes. Okay, so it could add to the tension of the passage, seeing that the same thing is happening. And do they know about that? Do they not know about that? Is it adding to the tension? That's helping us make more sense of our passage. Okay, great. What else?
And they're immediately in the marketplace, and they were healing. And so now they're coming out of the marketplace, and there's this discussion about when you come from the marketplace, you need to wash. And connecting maybe the unclean with the people that Jesus was healing. And so for him to pronounce all foods clean,
That's good. That's great. That's what we want to do. We want to chew on it. It's hard work. We want to figure out, why is this passage here? Why did Mark put this story after that story? And if this story wasn't even there, what would we be missing if he just left it out completely? Why is this story here, and how does it connect to what's going on before and after? So they're coming from the marketplace. This could add to the tension of the passage as well. Mm-hmm.
Well, and then we go into immediately talking about the Pharisees and the Jews do not eat unless they carefully wash their hands. And then that they, when they come from the marketplace, they don't eat unless they cleanse themselves. They've been doing ritual cleansings and stuff, so they're constantly trying to make sure that they are clean under the law. And seeing Jesus having everyone touching him, that also adds that tension. In the passage that we're looking at.
Yeah, so all of this previous context, what I'm hearing from you guys, is it's helping to explain, why is this the thing that the Pharisees are getting mad about? Are they just picking something random? Do they just want to be mad to be mad? Or is there something that's leading to this? Are there other events that are happening that are adding to the tension, that are showing us why this is going on? Okay, great. I'm loving this. What about following context, these four tables? First of all, what did you guys find? Sum it up.
A Gentile woman's daughter is a demon is cast out.
Okay, a Gentile woman's daughter has a demon cast out of her.
Without him even touching her.
Pardon?
Without him even touching her.
Oh, without him even touching. That's interesting. Okay.
Before that, he's trying to get away and be hidden, but he can't be hidden.
He's trying to get away and be hidden, but he can't be. Yeah, he can't escape. Okay, what is that bringing to the understanding of our passage? How does that inform? Yes.
Well, here the Pharisees are washing and they think they're holy, right? They think they're clean because they have washed themselves and because they're Jews. And here you have a woman who is an unclean Gentile, who's one of the dogs, right? And he heals her, not because of who she is, what she is, or how many times she's washed, but because she's asked and she believes he can do it.
Yes. Okay, did everybody hear her? In our passage, the Pharisees, who are supposed to be the cleanest of everyone, they don't get who Jesus is. They're angry that he's not clean. And then in the following passage, we have this Gentile woman who seems to somehow grasp something about what Jesus has come to do, having faith in him. She's the most unclean of all people. She's called a dog by the Pharisees in their time. And she gets it, and Jesus heals her daughter, not because of how clean she is, not because she's super religious. He heals her, and she's so it brings irony to our passage. How ironic that the most unclean person in all of the culture gets who Jesus is and comes to him in faith and is healed, and the most clean people in the culture, they don't get it. They're angry at him over ridiculous things. So it's bringing irony to our passage. So do you see how it's not completely changing? I said that the emphasis was what makes a person clean or unclean. As we move through the question, the rebuke, the explanation, it's not completely changing the meaning of our passage, but it's bringing understanding. It's informing our passage. So when we go to write the answer to question number 3, what argument is the author advancing to his audience? That's going to help shape our answer because it's helping us to understand the passage better. Okay, I love this. This is great. Does anybody have any questions about literary context before we move on to the next one? Yes.
Would it be like if there's references to other scripture in the Bible, or is it just that book?
We are going to get to that context. Literary context is just the book that you're in. Yep. First the passages immediately before and after, and then expanding to the whole book. Okay, any other questions on literary context? Yes. Yep, that's the same exact question. She's asking, when we use the words, how does it inform the meaning of my text? She's asking, can she rephrase that in her head? How does it bring understanding? Yep, that's exactly. We're wanting to know how it's helping us understand. How does it inform the meaning of our text? Okay, our next context is biblical context. So our definition for biblical context is quotations or allusions to previous passages of the Bible that the author is making. So, strategies for finding biblical context. What do you think they're going to be if we're talking about quotations or allusions that the author is making to previous passages of the Bible? Cross-references? Okay, how are you going to know if the cross-reference is just word association that the people who translated the Bible are doing, or if it's an actual quote?
If it's in quotations.
If it's in quotations, yeah. A lot of times the Bible will, the different translations, they'll set it apart. They'll put it in quote marks, and they'll give the cross-reference for it. So if we find a quotation, what do we need to do? Look it up. Yep, that's our strategy. We want to look up the quotations or allusions. And after we look it up, what do we need to do? Can't just look it up. What do you got to do?
Read it.
You got to read it. You got to understand it. This is going to make your Bible study longer because now you have to understand two passages. You're looking up the quotation and the allusion, and you're trying to understand what it means, and then you have to see how is the author or speaker in your passage using the quote or allusion. So sometimes when we're reading a passage, our mind makes connections with other parts of the Bible. I love this. This is wonderful. This is great. If this happens to you, I'm glad you know your Bible well. This did not happen to me when I was a new believer. It didn't even happen to me when I was a new Bible teacher. I did not know my Bible well. I could not have told you, oh, this word is used here. Oh, this is talked about there. So the more that you're doing that, the better it is. I love that. These connections aren't always biblical context. Sometimes they are. Sometimes they're theological reflection. Sometimes they're simple word association. So how do we figure out if it's a quotation or allusion? We want to make sure that we are only looking at connections that the original author is making. So as we said, a quotation is going to be a lot easier. A lot of times your Bible will set it apart. It'll have quotes. It'll be word for word from the Old Testament, from whatever book they're quoting. So when you look up that quotation, one thing that you want to do is you don't want to just look up that verse. If the author of the New Testament, if the author in the Gospel is quoting a passage from the Old Testament and he's quoting a verse, he's wanting to draw the mind of his reader to that whole passage. So you are looking up that verse that he's quoting, but then you're reading that whole passage and you're seeing how is he using it in this passage. So as I said, that takes a lot of work because now you have to understand two passages. So in our text, in Mark 7, 1 to 23, do you see any quotations? We're just looking at quotations now. We're going to talk about allusions in a minute. Do you see any quotations in the text? Pardon? Isaiah 29:13. And where is that in our passage? Okay. Mark 7, I'm going to say 6 to 7. All right, is there anything else?
Verse 10 is from Deuteronomy.
Yep. Mark 7, 10. It's from, wait, where are you saying it's from?
Well, Exodus and then Deuteronomy.
Exodus and then Deuteronomy, yeah. So which one are we going to go back to?
Probably Exodus because that's the first one.
Okay, yeah, probably Exodus because it's the first one. I like that. And where is it coming from in Exodus?
The Ten Commandments.
Yep, 20:12. It's repeated in 21:17. Okay, so we're going to jot those down. We're going to come back to those in just a minute. Those are quotations. Allusions are more difficult. Allusions are when it's not a direct quotation. It's not Moses said X, Y, and Z, and you can turn back and you can see Moses saying X, Y, and Z. Allusions are when you think that the author of the book is trying to draw your mind to another passage, but it's not a quotation. So you think that the author is intentionally trying to get you to think of something that came earlier in the Bible. So if you believe that the author is making an allusion, you want to look for proof to back that up. So you need to ask yourself a few questions. Number one, was the material that you think that the author is alluding to even available for him to allude to it? Did it even exist? If you think that the author is trying to draw your mind back to something, think, did that even exist? So if I'm in Genesis, and I think that there's a connection between Genesis and something that Paul says, could Moses be trying to draw his audience back to something that Paul wrote? No. So if you think there's a connection between something that Moses says in Genesis and something that Paul says, what is that? Theological reflection. I love that you're making that connection. That is awesome. But jot it down on the side of your paper, whatever it is that you take notes on, however it is that you do your Bible study, jot it down and come back to it when you do your theological reflection. Because there's no way Moses is alluding to something that Paul wrote. We're thousands of years off the mark on that, hundreds of years off the mark on that. So that's the first question. Was the material even available? Number two, how many threads can I find that tie my passage back to this passage that I think the author is alluding to? If it's just one thread, if it's just one word, you might be doing word association. It might be an illusion. You need to look into it a little bit more. How many anchors, how sure are you that if the author was standing next to you and you said, hey, when you wrote about that, were you trying to get us to think about this? If he would be able to say yes, then great. That's what he's alluding to, but he's not here and he can't tell me. And so I have to really think, I have to pray about it, I have to wonder, and continually ask yourself, the refrain for context is, how does this inform the meaning of my passage? If you're doing all of this work and it's alluding back to something, and whether it is or it is not, it's not even helping you understand your passage, just forget about it. That's a rabbit trail. If you think that it's alluding to it, try and find things that will connect it. So I don't think there's an allusion in our Mark 7 passage, but I want to show you one quickly. So turn just one page back in your Bible to Mark 6, 32. Yes, question. Okay.
Isaiah rebukes the religious leaders in that Isaiah 6, you know, you're seeing, but you can see, but you don't see. You hear, but you don't understand.
Okay, so the question is in verse 18, then are you also without understanding? Do you not see that whatever goes in? So the question is.
Right, it's small there, but Mark uses that a lot.
Yeah, so she's saying Mark uses Isaiah a lot with the seeing and the perceiving. There's another place in the in our passages, yeah, where he says, I think that's, it's in one of our passages tomorrow, isn't it?
He's like addressing the Pharisees.
Yeah, so is that an allusion because Mark uses Isaiah? You have to decide that for yourself. You have to pray about it. You have to get with your women's team and talk to them about it, and you have to think about it. I've never looked into that before, so that's an interesting one. I'll definitely be looking into it after this workshop. So I want to draw us over to Mark 6, 32 to 44. And I'm going to do this a little bit quickly. We're not going to spend a ton of time on this because this is not our Mark 7. But in this passage, Jesus feeds a crowd of people. We talked about it in our literary context. When Mark describes the crowd in verse 34, he says, when he went ashore, Jesus, when Jesus went ashore, he saw a great crowd, and he had compassion on them because they were like sheep without a shepherd, and he began to teach them many things. Okay, that is not a quote. There's nowhere that I could say that he's quoting from. But why does Mark use this language? Why does he say Jesus had compassion on them because they were like sheep without a shepherd? I think Mark is trying to allude back to the Old Testament. I think he wants us to call to mind passages in the Old Testament about shepherds. And so one that kept on sticking out to me was Numbers 27:17. So this is right before Moses dies and he's concerned about the people because he's about to die and he can't go into the promised land. He says to God, who shall go out before them and come in before them, and who shall lead them out and bring them in, that the congregation of the Lord may not be as sheep that have no shepherd. So this is not a quote, but the language is very similar. The phrase is similar. And when you add to that the detail that later in the same passage in Mark 6, he tells them, 39, he commanded them all to sit down in groups on the green grass. Why did Mark put that detail? Why is he trying to make these people look like sheep? They're sitting on the green grass. They don't have a shepherd to watch over them. That was a theme. There's other passages in the Old Testament that talk about the people being without a shepherd. So I think that these details put together is strengthening my idea that this is an allusion back to Numbers. And it's Mark trying to paint a picture emphasizing the lostness, if I can make up that word, about the people about how they're this lost people without a sheep. This thing that Moses didn't want to happen is true now in our day because they don't have good shepherds. And so I think that the emphasis on how lost these people are is informing my passage in Mark about how he's feeding them. The emphasis is definitely on the feeding, but I think it's shaping the way that I'm looking at the feeding into Jesus being a shepherd providing. And so if I were to do a worksheet on Mark 6, I would say that I would have this listed as a possible biblical allusion. I would put it as possible. I'll admit there's not like 5 or 6 threads tying it together. I've got like maybe 2 or 3 tying it to this allusion. But I would wonder, is this an allusion to previous biblical context? And how does it inform my passage? It helps me see that Mark's not just, the passage isn't just like, oh, Jesus can do miracles and he can multiply fish and loaves. But the way that he's doing it is providing as a good shepherd. And so I think that's pushing the passage forward. So that would be an example of an allusion that I think is there. And you might argue with me, and that's great. I would love to have that argument. Yes. So, yeah, she's asking, could Psalm 23 also? Because, yep, I think that's a possibility as well. Yeah, so that's an allusion. I think that helps me see that he's come to shepherd his people. I think it's an allusion. I think it helps me understand that passage better. But we're going to go back. We're going to go back to our Mark 7 passage because I want you to look at these quotes. I want you to go back to Mark 7, 1 to 23 with the person next to you. We're going to look up. Let's split up the room again the same way that we did. Let's have this side look at the Mark 7, 6 to 7, the Isaiah 29 quote, and then we'll have this part of the room look at the 7:10, the Exodus quotes. And you want to go back. What's going on in the text quoted? How does that help inform the meaning of your text? Those are the two questions, so go for that. I'll give you a few minutes. Okay, I know this is so quick. We're going to come back together. Let me just say the work of structure and context, the exegesis line on our map, that takes me 8 to 10 hours. I've given you guys 4 minutes. I know this is quick. We're trying to learn the principles and put them into practice. Okay, so this side of the room, how did the Isaiah 29:13 passage help for what's going on in it, and how did it help you understand your text? Did we get that far?
I think it helped. It kind of gave context to like the Pharisees and like the same issues that were happening in Isaiah and how the people were hard-hearted. Jesus is saying like these are, like you are doing the same thing today.
Okay, and what's going on? What's exactly going on in the Isaiah passage? Yeah. So in the Isaiah passage, he's prophesying to the people. They're not listening to him. It's judgment that he's bringing down on them. And you're saying it helps to inform our text because the same thing's happening in our passage. So it helps to bring, I think it helps to bring that note of judgment. I think it's there already, but it helps us see it's still happening. Isaiah prophesied about it long before. Is that what you guys find back there? Do you want to add to that? So she's saying it brings a contrast between those who hear and understand and follow God and those who don't. So yeah, it's drawing a pretty hard line between the Pharisees and Jesus because they're on the wrong side of the line. So it's strengthening the judgment in our passage.
Jesus is saying, what they did to God is what you're also doing to me.
Yeah, so she's saying, did everybody hear that? It's bringing Jesus' authority to light, that he actually has the authority to pronounce this judgment, because it's coming from God. Okay, what did you guys find on this side of the room in Exodus? What was it, and how did it help you understand the passage? Yes.
Okay, if I'm catching on here. Okay, so Exodus, of course, they were talking about the commandments. So we go back here and they're talking about, they're saying, you know, they're trying to catch him up, saying, you saying all this stuff and you unclean, you didn't wash your hands, you didn't do this, you didn't do that. And Jesus said, you're focusing on the wrong thing. Mm-hmm. You're missing the point of it. It's about the commandments. It's about going back, not putting in all this stuff from man, but what originally came from the Father, these commandments. And one of them was, you're not even doing the basics. Honor your mother and father. You're not doing, you worried about who's clean hands and who got dirty hands and who eating bread.
Yeah, exactly. So they're trying to catch Jesus out using the prophets, and he's actually turning the tables on them. So, I mean, to me, that kind of brings humor. To it, and it shows the seriousness of what they're rejecting. They're rejecting God himself, his law, in favor of their traditions. Okay, great. So the biblical context is informing our text. It's helping us understand. It's giving us nuance. It's showing us what notes are there that we need to be paying attention to. Cultural context is our last one. Cultural context is defined as details relevant to life as it was lived in that place and that time. In the passage. So these are things that we might not understand because we are 21st century Americans living here and now, and we don't understand it because of who we are, but they would have understood it in the passage. So strategies, it's really what culture, just asking yourself the question, what would they have understood? That I need to figure out to understand as they did. I know that's a long question, but that's what we're trying to drive at with cultural context. What would they have understood in their culture that I need to understand in order to understand the passage as they would? So, we're jotting that down. We're looking up these terms and concepts that need to be understood. Where do you think you can find these terms and concepts that they would have understood automatically that we need to kind of figure out? Old Testament, yeah, that's a helpful resource. Go back to the Old Testament and figure out where are these customs coming, where are these phrases coming from? Where is this culture coming from? What else? Yeah, sometimes the book itself will explain it. If you're reading the whole book, sometimes that thing that isn't understandable will come up later and you'll be able to figure it out. I think a study Bible, they can be helpful. They can be helpful for pointing it out. Looking up terms in a Bible dictionary, looking at a different translation. Parallel. So she's saying, what about parallel passages with the gospel? Since we're in gospel specifically, I think that can be really helpful. Just always keeping in mind that Mark wrote his gospel for a reason. Luke wrote his gospel for a reason. John. So it can help you, like, I don't understand it here. Maybe he explained it better. Just don't try to combine them because they are separate gospels. Yeah, I think that can be helpful. So you need to go, you need to do your own work. You need to figure out what's going on in the passage and then go and look these things up. Ask your pastor. Ask your women's ministry team. Things like that. And so what's jumping out at you in this passage that might be cultural context that needs to be looked up? Pardon? Yeah, like what are the traditions of man? What is that? What specifically is that talking about? Washing couches? What are they talking about when they, like, would I wash my sofa? What is that? What is a couch to them? Yeah. Anything else? Is it okay to Google it? It depends on who you're, depends on who you're reading after you Google it. If it's a reliable source, yeah. I would just be careful. Yeah. Where are you getting your information on Google? Good question. Is there anything else that jumps out in the, yes?
And so sometimes if you're reading the Old Testament and then you think, well, where are they getting all these laws? And Jesus alludes to that when he talks about these are things that are handed down by men. And so they can be really, I found that interesting to study. And some of that is just, you know, going to commentaries and stuff that Old Testament researchers that have done more work.
Yeah. So she's saying one of the cultural context pieces that you might need to look up is who are the Sadducees? Who are the Pharisees? What's going on? Like, who are these people? Why are they in control? When did they come to power? Looking that up can help you make sense of the passage. Yeah, that's good. Okay, with each of these types of contexts, we're gaining insight into our passage. It isn't completely changing the meaning of the passage. Sometimes it does. Sometimes it completely unlocks the passage, and you're like, I would have gotten this 100% wrong if I had not looked at this. Most of the time, it's helping shape and shift your perspective in nuanced ways. The question that you're always asking with each type of these contexts is, what is it? How does it inform the meaning of my passage? What understanding does it bring? And so these passages, it showed us the irony. We're still at the emphasis of what makes somebody clean or unclean. But all of these contexts showed us that there's irony, there's humor. It's reminding us that Jesus brought a new law, that there's the covenant, that they're completely forgetting the level of judgment, helping us make sense of the customs of washing, what Corban means. That's another one for cultural context. The context informs the meaning of our text, giving us a clearer picture of what the author was trying to teach his audience. So let me just go back to our principle. We must understand the context to see how the original audience understood the text.